This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. Justice Department demands to know the identities of 1.3 million people because they visited a website. Much of the U.S. Congress wants to make it a crime to boycott Israel, and prisoner rights advocates demand repeal of the amendment that makes slavery legal in the United States. But first, in the wake of racist violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, the airwaves are full of discussion about President Trump's ties to the so-called alt-right. Just what is President Trump's core political base? We asked author and veteran journalist Chris Hedges.
I don't think that there's much of an ideological foundation to the Trump support. Trump himself, of course, has no ideology at all. I think that it's more an attempt to find an ideological veneer that sanctifies the rage of a dispossessed white working class. The Christian right does this. All sorts of hate groups do this. Militias, neo-Nazi groups. And they're all interconnected because, in the end, it's about a Christianized fascism of white Americans, those who defend the Civil War. The Confederacy is not a movement to prolong slavery, but in fact a movement that is concerned with states' rights, et cetera, et cetera. It's all interconnected, but I think it's a mistake to think that these are ideologically sophisticated. There are people who deal in cliches. The Christian right certainly does. I attended Harvard Divinity School. I know the Bible. They don't. They pick and choose. They're selective literalists. They pick and choose what short biblical passages or quips that buttress their hatred and their racism and their misogyny and their lust for imperialism and violence. So yes, I think it's all interconnected. But I think the root is this sense that their white identity has been taken away from them, which it has, but not by black people or people of color or Muslims or anyone else. It's been taken away from them by the corporate state that has deindustrialized the country and done to them what it is done to the rest of the working class. The difference being, and it's a difference that James Baldwin points out, is that black people, because of white supremacy, are much more reticent about buying into the myth of America, that you can have everything you want if you just work hard and follow your dreams. But white people do, and Baldwin, I think, says quite presciently that that's why so many white people in their 40s, white men in particular, have these kinds of midlife crises that black men don't, because black men get it. And in fact, the corporate state discards everyone, black, brown, yellow, white, it doesn't matter. And what it's done, I think, and we saw this really the beginning of this with Margaret Thatcher and with Reagan, is that when they made war on those social support systems, on the manufacturing base that once provided a middle class living to the white working class, they shifted. Stuart Hall writes about this. They shifted the focus to being an assault on white identity by cultural forces, and in particular, whether that's LGBT or whatever, liberals, et cetera, but in particular, of course, people of color. So I think that's what's happening.
Yes, but these folks who don't have these social support systems anymore don't rant and rave and rail against the folks who took away those social support systems. They blame the blacks and others.
Well, of course they do, because the whole kind of national consensus that was created, manufactured, Gramsci, of course, understands the power of cultural manipulation. And let's be clear, the Democratic Party under Biden and Clinton were as complicit in this as the Republicans. It shifted to quote-unquote law and order, the war on drugs, which, as you know better than anyone, were just code words for the demonization or re-demonization of people of color, and in particular, black people. So they shifted the kind of framework. And the commercial media was the great enabler of this. We're watching it now with the absurd kind of focus on Russia, as if 70 million people voted for Trump because of Russia, or as if millions or tens of millions of Hillary Clinton supporters woke up and read the Podesta emails and said, that's it, I'm voting for Trump. Or if you read the Director of National Intelligence report, as if everybody was watching RT America, where I have a show, which no one watches, and they voted for the third party. I mean, it's complete absurdism, which the media echoes. And meanwhile, I just came back from Indiana and did a little program out there in Anderson, Indiana, called The End of the Line, which you can watch online. I just took a half hour to talk to these people in this former GM center where there's nothing. And by the end of that half hour, you get it. And watching the media, the commercial media, utterly ignore that suffering, and they've long ignored the suffering, of course, of even more marginalized segments of the society, perpetuates a non-reality-based narrative that is as pernicious as the one that's peddled by the lunatics around Donald Trump.
Charlottesville reminded me of a kind of 1957 Little Rock kind of moment, a time when the United States was embarrassed deeply before the world as the cameras showed mobs of white people, mostly white women, screaming and cursing and clearly wanting to kill little black children. Is this such a moment? Certainly the Russians didn't have anything to do with Little Rock and nothing to do with Charlottesville either.
I think it's actually more dangerous in this sense because, as many radicals point out, the effect of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society was, because of the quote-unquote war on poverty, was that it was able to buy off a lot of the black radical movements that had a kind of political and, in particular, revolutionary consciousness. And, of course, those movements that didn't succumb, like the Panthers or the Black Liberation Army, then they just went out and assassinated and imprisoned them. I think that what we're seeing now is that the state doesn't have the economic weaponry by which they can buy off either disenfranchised whites or anyone else. What we did see, which I think it's a correct historical analogy, is the passivity on the part of the police, who one must assume has a great deal of sympathy for these white racists, as of course they did in Little Rock or Birmingham or anywhere else. And so you had a situation where Cornel West and other clergy figures were marching and were in serious physical danger from these pseudo-crypto-fascist thugs. And you had Antifa and those groups intervene. Now, that's a very dangerous situation to be in. I'm glad they intervened. But when you have a lack of policing like that, then you give rise to movements like Antifa, the Black Bloc, or on the other side, these kind of neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates who really speak almost exclusively in the language of force. That's what I saw that frightened me. And I think the state, I mean, we're watching the kind of terminal decline of American empire. And that means that the tools that empire has to mitigate unrest have diminished significantly from the 1950s and the 1960s. It's almost exclusively now through coercion and violence and wholesale surveillance, which is, if you look at the pictures of the police in 1957 and you look at the pictures of police now, you see police who look like stormtroopers with Kevlar-plated body armor, long-barreled weapons, and everything else, and that's symptomatic of where we're going.
Yes, the Charlottesville police, at least to this date, have not pursued warrants against any of the five young white men who were beating a black man viciously on camera, even though they've been identified.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, and yeah, I teach in a prison, and it's no secret that you find in the prison system, like many police forces, you know, a great affinity between these white racist groups and law enforcement. I mean, look at every time you see the head of the Fraternal Brotherhood of Police in Philadelphia get up and attack Mumia Abu-Jamal, you know, he looks like a character out of a Southern white hate group. And that's dangerous because when policing is, and policing, of course, is not in any way impartial or fair, but when policing, as it did in Charlotte, Charlottesville essentially just walks away and lets these two groups battle it out in the street, then you are empowering kind of mercenary forces on both sides. So, yeah, I mean, the whole system is falling apart. And I think what we witnessed is, unfortunately, you know, what we're going to see more of.
The Democrats and lots of Republicans and corporate leaders and military chiefs are calling for a kind of national unity response to Charlottesville. National unity around what?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, national unity. I mean, that's what they always call for, you know, patience and unity and tolerance. It's a word even Martin Luther King never used. Look, the kind of nakedness of the American kleptocracy, and by that I don't just mean the personal kleptocracy of the Trump family, which is public and egregious and criminal, but the kleptocracy of corporations now that are dismantling whatever tepid regulations and reforms, whether it's in the EPA or Dodd-Frank or the SEC or anything else. It's just, I mean, Karl Marx got it, the late stage of capitalism is just unfettered, unregulated pillage, exploitation, and greed. That's what we're watching. And the moral bankruptcy of the systems of power is evident, I think, to all sides within the political spectrum. I mean, look at this ridiculous attempt by Chuck Schumer and the Democratic Party to continue to mainline Wall Street money. And, of course, marginalize Bernie Sanders and those around Bernie Sanders, thinking they can just do business as they've always done. And that just shows you how out of touch they are with the rest of the population. And that kind of obtuse, willful blindness on the part of the elites across the spectrum, I mean, whether it's Paul Ryan or Pelosi or anyone else, presages further disintegration and social unraveling. And because of the endemic violence within American culture, we are a deeply violent society, as Richard Hofstadter and many others, Malcolm X and others have understood. That's very frightening. I mean, we already see not only over 3 largely unarmed people of color gunned down in the streets a day by American police forces, but we can't forget the number of fatalities from gunshots, most of which, by the way, are suicides, along with these mall shootings and cinema shootings and school shootings. These are all symptoms of a society that is very, very diseased. And with an elite, you know, both Republican and Democrat, that sole focuses on personal and corporate greed, which is, of course, why we're still in Afghanistan, so Raytheon and Halliburton can pull in money. I mean, it's not good for Afghanistan. It's not good for America. It's good for them. There is nothing now that's going to impede their cannibalization for profit. And that, coupled with what's happening within the renting apart of the fabric of American society, is, I mean, we're headed for, I think, I don't know when. I learned as a reporter you can never predict timelines, but we're certainly headed for some very disturbing and violent acts of disintegration. Remember that both sides came to Charlottesville heavily armed, and all you needed was one idiot to pull out a Glock and start firing, and all the other idiots would have pulled out whatever weapons they had and started firing, which is going to happen, and then you're going to have a bloodbath.
That was author and journalist Chris Hedges. More than 200 demonstrators face felony charges stemming from protests at Donald Trump's inauguration last January 20th in Washington. Trump's Justice Department is trying to force an internet hosting company to reveal the identities of all 1.3 million people that visited a website involved in organizing the inauguration protests. Civil liberties groups say the administration has declared war on First Amendment guarantees of freedom of speech. We asked Chip Gibbons, legislative counsel with the group Defending Rights and Dissent, if there is any precedent for the Justice Department's dragnet.
It's pretty unconscionable. I know there was a case a few years back. It came up in the briefs about trying to get information from Amazon about people who bought a book, but I don't know of anything quite like this. and it's completely unfamiliar to me. I was very shocked when I first heard about this, although with all of the J20 prosecutions, I've been repeatedly shocked. So we are living in unusual times.
Well, what does unusual times mean in terms of legal precedent and what folks once called the looming police state? Is this that state that loomed once?
Well, the police state isn't looming so much anymore. I think it might actually be here. In terms of legal precedent, I mean, with the warrant, there are two issues from a constitutional perspective with it. First and foremost, there's the basic Fourth Amendment issues that are inherent to any warrant request. They have to be reasonable. They have to be specific. The warrant that the Justice Department has cited for all demanding practically all company records and information associated with the website Disrupt J20 is absolutely broad. And I don't think anybody can say that is a reasonable or specific warrant. They're claiming that there is property about a riot, but you can't legitimately say that every single email and every single IP address to this website, which had information about all of the Donald Trump protest, is in fact evidence of a riot or the fruits of a riot. It's really very shocking for anyone to even make that claim. So it's an overly broad warrant just on the basic face of the Fourth Amendment. And of course, if the Justice Department gets this information, they're getting information about First Amendment protected speech. When a warrant implicates the First Amendment, there is a heightened level of scrutiny applied to it, not as much as I think there should be, but that is a consideration the court will have to take into account. So, I mean, this warrant, I'm hoping that the judge who is hearing the case about it will completely reject it. It is unconstitutional under the Fourth and First Amendment. But, I mean, while legal proceedings like this are important, and I'm glad that the Electronic Frontier Foundation is representing DreamHost, I think you and I both know that these matters are not just decided in the courts. They're decided by social movements. They're decided by political organizing, and that the courts oftentimes go along with the political temperament of the times. So it's very important that we continue organizing, we continue speaking out, and we make it very clear that we, the people, reject this warrant and try to put pressure on the Justice Department to withdraw it.
It looks like the Justice Department is trying to use the courts to expand the ongoing efforts for social and political mapping, that is, drawing maps of political affinity groups for further use down the road by the state.
I mean, it's really shocking what the Justice Department is doing. I mean, they claim in their warrant that they're looking for evidence of violation of the D.C. rioting statute. There is no way anybody can look at the information they're requesting and say that there's a legitimate law enforcement purpose here. You know, the 1.3 million IP addresses are not pertinent to rioting charges. But so it raises the question, what are they doing? And I think it's pretty clear they're trying to silence and chill and intimidate people from speaking out. I mean, there's no other explanation for them wanting to get this large amount of information, most of which would be useless to an actual criminal investigation, but would be perfectly good for, you know, compiling dossiers on people about their political views or just generally sending a message, hey, we're watching you, in hopes that people, you know, stay silent and don't speak out against the continued abuses of the Trump administration.
And how has this development, what impact does it have on the courtroom battle around those who have actually been arrested for activities during the inauguration?
So I'm not entirely certain how it's going to directly impact those who are currently charged, but I would like to point out that those charges are also, like the warrant, really bogus and really threatening to the First Amendment. I mean, over 200 people have been charged with felony crimes, including felony rioting. The prosecutors admit that while there was property that was destroyed and while allegedly a law enforcement officer was injured, all of the 214 people charged did not do those things. In fact, one of the people charged was not even present at the so-called riot. And instead, what they're arguing is that by protesters being at a demonstration where somebody else committed an illegal act, they are somehow guilty for that act as well. And that flies in the face of all of the established First Amendment principles. It flies in the face of all of the established principles of criminal procedure. And it flies in the face of international human rights law. I mean, if I go to a political protest and a stranger I've never met before does something unlawful, the police are supposed to deal with that person, not arrest me and for exercising my constitutional rights. It's completely abhorrent. It's part of a wider crackdown of dissent in this country. If you look across the country, a lot of state legislators are considering anti-protest laws, and they operate on the same sort of guilt by association logic, which is where people at a protest or organizers of a protest can be held liable either civilly or criminally for the actions of other parties, which is just astonishing to me. And I think the impact here is really very clear that for most people, if they go to a protest and someone they've never met before throws a rock or something, they're going to go to jail for several decades. They're going to decide, in many cases, I'm going to stay home. I'm not going to speak out against injustice. And we really have to fight back because this prosecution, this warrant, the whole landscape of the crackdown on dissent is meant to silence us. And as a result, there's never been a more compelling reason for us to raise our voices.
It sounds like a bizarre expansion on conspiracy law or interpretation of conspiracy law.
It is. I mean, one of the charges against the J20 defendants is conspiracy, but there are a number of non-conspiracy charges against them as well, and they're using the same kind of logic, which is that the entire assembly was an unlawful riot, and you had an opportunity to leave, and you didn't. And, you know, in the actual indictment, as evidence against the protesters, they mentioned they were chanting, you know, whose streets are streets? And if you've ever been to a protest, I'm sure you've heard that. And it's the idea that probably one of the most common activist chants in the U.S. is evidence of a felony that could get you in jail for decades. It's just absolutely shocking. I mean, you know, we at Defending Rights and Dissent have been fighting crackdowns on free speech since the House Un-American Activities Committee. So, I mean, very little surprises us. But even taking that into account, I'm a little bit shocked by just the vociferous nature of this nationwide attack on the right to dissent right now.
And the 1.3 million people who visited the site might be considered predisposed to engage in conspiratorial and felonious behavior.
That's a really interesting theory. I hadn't considered that. That is true that with entrapment cases, they do try to argue that you were predisposed, and that's why we have all these FBI cases where the FBI goes in and they find someone, they pressure him to commit a phony terrorist attack that doesn't actually exist, and then they charge him or her with all kinds of things, and they say, oh, you were predisposed to it. This is an entrapment. I had not ever considered that they could be doing that, but that is definitely of concern.
Well, maybe somebody at the Justice Department is thinking along those lines.
I would not put it past them. I mean, it's Jeff Sessions' Justice Department now. I mean, the Justice Department has never been particularly interested in justice. But now that we have Jeff Sessions in charge, who is very hostile to the First Amendment, he was very hostile to free speech rights as a senator. He was very hostile to free speech rights as an Alabama prosecutor. And he was very hostile to free speech rights as a federal prosecutor. It's out of the frying pan into the fire, as they say.
That was Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent in Washington. August is traditionally a time to support the rights of those incarcerated in the U.S. prison gulag. This August 19th saw rallies in cities around the country under the theme Millions for Prisoners' Human Rights, with the biggest event in Washington, D.C. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Brother D, a currently incarcerated prison abolition activist who'd rather that prison officials not know his real name. Brother D said the mobilization was a big success, despite the competition from racist statues and the eclipse of the sun.
First of all, I got to say it turned out fantastic. I think it turned out a lot more better than what people actually thought it would turn out. We had a lot of solidarity events around the nation, from California to New Mexico to New York City. I think it was somewhere in Buffalo. We also had it. We had a few in Asheville. We had one in Asheville, North Carolina. So let me just say this here, right? I think the energy level forward and coming out of it is definitely positive. As it relates to the prisoners inside, I think the prisoners inside were definitely rejuvenated, and this is what we was trying to do. We was trying to spark the conversation also inside the prisons as well to get the prisoners to understanding the support that we actually have on the outside for resistance on the inside. So I think that went quite well. Of course, we did have a few problems in a couple of different places, inside and outside.
I'd imagine you're referring to the total lockdown of the Florida Department of Corrections, as well as some of the other tactics to suppress, as well as to discredit the actions and the organizing around August 19th. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I guess I could start inside, first of all, inside the prison. A number of states did go on lockdown. The full assessment, the full impact and the full repression tactic that was used by the state and the federal government, because I understand a few federal government institutions like Atlanta UPS was also on lockdown as well, has not actually come out yet. What we do know so far is we had Florida, the entire statewide lockdown. It was going through taking their property, confiscating, locking them up, transferring them. In some cases, I've heard there's been a few assaults as well, perpetrated by the officers themselves trying to handle the prisoners aggressively. We know this was in direct response to A-19 actually trying to lock them down, I think, before A-19 came in, because they claimed that there was some security concerns. And actually, I got some information from my understanding now from the outside and the inside that there was going to be a major disruption throughout the prison system. So they decided to go ahead and try to strip everybody out by the tactics they pulled. South Carolina, very similar as well. We didn't have mass shakedowns in the state of South Carolina. But what they did have in the state of South Carolina, they had limited shakedowns at certain prisons. They also had a few shakeups, a few transfers to other facilities. My understanding there as well, they had some reports, they call it credible evidence, that there was going to be mass disturbances occurring on George Jackson anniversary on the 21st. So they actually locked them down on the day of the eclipse, and then didn't let them back up. They actually locked them down prior, early that morning, and didn't let them back up until today. They're just coming back up this morning, all with the exception of one prison. I'm also hearing reports that we had women at the women's facility in Denver. I'm hearing they set it down the entire day, refused a meal. So that's excellent. I'm also hearing we had a few prisons out in California. But right now, like I say, everything has not come in yet as to what's going on and even who is actually still being punished or locked down at this particular moment. Outside-wise, I think everything went fantastic. We did have, as you all know, we had solidarity events, as I was saying, all over. I think the major solidarity event that took place that people overlooked was Boston. Instead, people tended to focus on the counter-protest against the neo-Nazis that was inside the area, but failed to look at Boston's list of demands, solidarity demands, you know, which mirrored what we was asking everybody in the country to do, was if you're going to protest on any level, to at least acknowledge prisoners on this day, A-19, but not only acknowledge prisoners, but to also recognize the fact that we're all challenged in the 13th, and in their list of demands of ending white supremacy, they did list the 13th Amendment. And also, I think it's something else that's very important to note here, too. A lot of people don't like to hear it when we say we're challenging white supremacy, but they have to understand that the 13th Amendment, as we've always said, is a legacy of white supremacy inside this country. The 13th Amendment was founded on a racial issue. After they so-called supposed to free the slaves during the Civil War, they compromised, and this compromise created an exception clause, and this exception clause was so the black people inside this country, we cannot get away from the racial issue in this country, which is why we say when we challenge the 13th, you're fundamentally challenging white supremacy in this country.
And we've discussed the general corporate state media whiteout that is thrown up against any kind of action, especially of a mass nature, against prison slavery in those clear terms. So in your estimation, because the corporate state media and their complicity in prison slavery clearly would inhibit them or at least deter them from accurately and honestly covering these kinds of issues. As regards on the inside, what do you think it is that prison slavers find so dangerous about those on the inside being able to recognize, participate in, and know about actions being held in their name, on their behalf, or with them as regards prison slavery?
I got to say this right here, very similar to August the 21st. Nat Turner when Nat Turner seen the eclipse. I think that is very scary for them. And I think also knowing that these type of events is taking place around the country is very scary for them, because that is the eclipse. The many prisoners can see all these solidarity events taking place. We did have a complete whiteout of the news media. And it was done for that exact reason, to have prisoners and even their families and loved ones that's outside to not know that they had this much solidarity taking place in this country. You have to look at this. We had the biggest national demonstration in this country's history ever against the 13th Amendment and white supremacy in this country, and it was not covered. What was covered was just the confrontational stages of the Boston incident. Now, it's not like any of these news media did not know that this event was ongoing, because everyone is clearly all over social media. You can Google it in any time. And clearly everybody was on point with it. And even Florida, when they published why they was locking down the prisoners, I'm thinking they inadvertently reported that they was locking them down due to the A-19 and these Prisoners' Human Rights March. But even when they noted that, it would have seemed like some type of media would have usually latched onto it and did a further investigation and at least started reporting more wider on the subject. But they didn't, because all of this was definitely intentional. And like I say, the reason they cannot have people doing this, because they understand the minute the challenges begin to rise up, we're challenging a fundamental issue here. You're talking about a structural change in this country. You're talking about a structural change that would change the nature of this country, how this country even governs those that they consider those that have fallen short, how they're going to handle those that have fallen short inside the society. This particular clause is fundamental when you're talking about the justice system, a slave system. You know, you're talking about changing all of that. And they can't afford to allow people to wake up to that, because this thing has been here since the founding of this country. And quite honest, I still don't think they actually know what they're going to do when they have to get rid of it. So I think it's very scary for them to even have that thought right there, that eventually they're going to have to do away with it.
No doubt. Just to attach some of the figures to this lockdown that occurred in the Florida Department of Corrections, Florida has the third largest Department of Corrections in the United States, with a total of 148 facilities. These facilities were locked down starting Thursday, directly before the August 19th Millions for Prisoner Human Rights March and Rally. And the spokesperson for the Florida Department of Corrections stated that there was a need for all of the correctional officers and probation officers, etc., throughout the Department of Corrections in Florida to all appear for work so that they could, quote unquote, search for weapons and other contraband. And I would also just like to note that there's reportedly no air conditioning throughout the Florida Department of Corrections. Could you just help to illustrate what it is that a lockdown is like in these prison plantations throughout the country?
Well, basically, when you lock down like that, trust me, especially no AC, because right now we're dealing with temperatures that's rising up. It's hot. It's in August. So you're dealing with temperatures no less than 90 degrees, especially down that Panhandle area in Florida. Usually during these lockdown periods, we're fed bad lunches. This means two boiled eggs in the morning times. This means usually a bagel, dry bagel at that, and a little bit of grits. This is what you usually fed for breakfast. You usually fed two sandwiches with four slices of bread, maybe a piece of bologna, which is usually green. It's not really bologna. We just call it bologna back here. Actually, it's mystery meat. A mayonnaise pack and a mustard pack for lunch usually. And for dinner, you may have a little piece of homemade cake, a little block of little cake that they call cake, by the way. It's not really cake. And another four slices of bread with maybe a carrot or something inside the bag. This is what we're actually eating during these lockdown periods. You're not eating any hot meals, you know. There's no canteen. You're not getting any showers. That means your body, the sweat that you're accumulating in that room between you and whoever else, that body sink is inside that room right there. No showers. Sometimes they try to give you a shower after 3 to 5 days, usually, but sometimes that's hard to do. They won't do it. It's hard to get a shower. And I mean, as far as other needed basic supplies, if you run out while you're inside your cell, then pretty much you're usually done. You won't have it. That means no soap. That means no toothpaste. That means no toothbrush. That means no canteen if you had the money to go to the commissary and buy canteen. So it becomes very frustrating on the prisoners. It becomes at times unbearable. You know, it raises a lot of tension levels at that particular time. This is just kind of what you're going through, and you're not moving. You're not moving in those cells. You're not, you know, you're stuck in that small cell, usually with another occupant. So this is kind of what's going on, you know, when you're inside those cells, unable to move and just trapped.
And given the claim by Department of Corrections officials that the lockdown was necessary in order to avoid or secure against any kinds of rebellions or uprisings or violence, would you say that locking down prison facilities alleviates or exacerbates conflict within the prisons?
I think it exacerbates it. I think what happens is a lot of times, like, you get an example, like in South Carolina when they locked down, what they've learned is that they can preemptively lock down prisons now. And I think they learned that during the September 9th strike, or not acknowledge certain things also. That was another tactic they used during the September 9th strike. But one of the things they learned is they lock down, and maybe just lock down for a day or two sometimes. Sometimes after they lock down, I guess they give the prisoners enough time to think. Those that may have been on the edge about resisting, they usually may not resist when they come up. Like in South Carolina, when they came up, my understanding, he had only one prison that remained locked down because threat level, security level was still high on a threat for disruption. And everyone else was up. People was talking, but it was not the hype talk that they once had after August the 19th. So I think in some cases it calms it down, but at the same time, too, it still has that boiling point there, because at any moment it can still go down. That frustration still is not going anywhere. It's just that the guys are ready to get out the cell, get around, have their business, take a shower, eat a hot meal, and this is kind of what's going on at that stage. So it's a new tactic they've started pulling as of recently, these preemptive strikes. But it definitely does not do away with it. It definitely does not take away from the fact that they have a situation on their hands. You know, it's just a matter of when it's going to blow up. You know, matter of fact, I personally feel like it only is going to get worse. Because once it finally blows up, and then it blows all the way over like a pot that's bubbling, and it bubbles all the way up, and they can't control it, and then you have this extreme form of violence, as some people would call it, an extreme form of violence that occurs. And then people wonder, what happened? Where did this come from? Well, it's been boiling on the surface. Right now, what they're doing in Florida is they're shaking these guys down. They're taking their personal property. They're beating them up. They're transferring them. They got them locked down in these high cells. And what this is definitely a form of repression and retaliation. You know what I'm saying? But what's going to happen is one day it's going to be the uprising, because this does not answer the grievances of the prison. Because the only reason prisoners want to rise up like we do is because we have legitimate grievances, and usually it pertains to our human rights or injustice that's occurring. And they're still not addressing them. Instead, they try to address them through repression.
Right. Now, just to bring it back to the day of the Millions for Prisoner Human Rights March, August 19th, the demands were very clear as regards altering the 13th Amendment, removing the exception clause. Could you discuss a bit more about those kinds of political and legal tactics around this development with regard to prisoners' human rights and the abolition of modern slavery?
One of the things we did recognize is that in our prison resistance movement is that we felt like the 13th Amendment, not only was it a linchpin to a lot of other issues that we are actually dealing with in the prisons and outside, because this is a prison class issue, you know, because once you're convicted, you lose your voting rights, you know. Once you're convicted, you can also lose your home, you know, because housing discrimination takes place out there. So this is a prison class issue. But nonetheless, though, we figured this was a unification point as well for a lot of the different segments in this prison resistance movement that was fighting on different fronts, on different levels. Now, what we can say about it as far as the 13th Amendment, by having it amended, we do feel like once it's amended, it changes the whole landscape to a degree, okay, to a degree, because we feel like because of the linchpin, it helps us more easily to kick over the rest of the linchpins, because as a revolutionary, myself speaking, we believe that the whole system has to be dismantled. We have, and so what we're doing, we're going through a dismantling process. And we just see this as the most essential piece. Once again, you know, it's just the essential piece right here. You know, it does not solve all of our problems, but it starts us in the right place as a domino effect. And a lot of people have seen this, and no matter how you may view it or how you may look at it, everyone can agree that morally having legalized slavery on your books is wrong. There's one more demand, so I didn't hear you mention, but we're also pushing for congressional hearings. As we begin to form, my understanding now, after March, and within 30 days there's going to be an announcement as to the actual after game plan. Municipal Prisons Human Rights March has transitioned its name to the Municipal Prisons Human Rights Coalition. But a lot of the resisting elements, we're expecting to come together as a coalition and continue the pressure on the elected officials of this country, as well as to continue direct actions inside the streets, because we want to see more direct confrontation with the prison system being on their property. We want to see direct confrontation with some of these law enforcement being on their property. These are things that we need to see. These are things that we need to hear, because it's the only thing that's going to get the people's attention, including the elected officials' attention, to know that there has to be some changes, because right now, they are allowed to ignore us. And the whole reason, also another fundamental reason for the nationalism call, was so they can no longer ignore us. So our people can be our voice out there, because they can't ignore you all, but they can ignore us. All they have to do is shut the door on us, stop us from getting visits, stop our phone calls, stop our mail. You all don't hear us. You follow me? But they can't stop you all.
Right. And unlike gatherings and rallies and meetings, which the corporate state media apparatus can refuse to shed light on, refuse to cover, etc., with a congressional hearing, the people would have to be exposed to the realities of prison slavery. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It would have to be exposed. That's something you can't bury at that point. And that's what we're hoping. We're hoping that that ends up hitting. Like I say, every demonstration, we're looking for the same demands to be carried out. The same demands. We're going to be repeated. We're going to be repetitive about it. Prisoners are going to be repetitive about it. If you notice, we've been coming since September 9th and before that, during George Jackson time, repeating the same thing against this prison slavery that's going on. It is all back to the same fundamental question. We feel like it's building up more now, and that's what this shows now. I do want to say this here. I got to make sure that it's understood clearly that August the 9th could not have happened without the different organizations, the different groups, and the different people out there getting involved, getting their hands in. I mean, and the main thing at the end of the day for the prisoners back here, for our organizing committee, Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, our main thing was that we wanted more focus on the 13th, and we need to bring in more groups, because we noticed something about the September the 9th is that some of the groups that should have been involved was not involved. And these were some very progressive and revolutionary groups, and we was trying to figure out why these groups was not involved in pushing the September the 9th and supporting the September the 9th. And a lot of it had to do with the fact of a lack of communication. They were definitely not in the loop, not connected to the prison resistance movement as they should have been. Well, we saw that fundamentally change August the 19th.
Yes, and you mentioned George Jackson. We acknowledge and recognize his assassination as a part of the Black August tradition. Would you like to just speak on George Jackson's role in all of this?
First of all, let me say August the 19th, it was the opening of the March in Washington, D.C. Crystal Roundtree, the core organizer for the Municipal Prisons and Human Rights Organizing Committee, as well as the director of IMWE Prison Advocacy Network, gave a shout out as well as a recognition of Comrade George Jackson by quoting his quote, you know, related to selling all of our quarrels and coming together. And that's how she opened the actual event up in Washington, D.C. Comrade George Jackson, people have to understand something. He was a phenomenal brother. He's been inspirational to a lot of us back here in the prisons throughout the nation. The resistance that he laid down, the map that he laid down, it has been followed. It has been a tradition in the prisons and even on the street, which we find in Black August, Resistance Month. I don't think right now that people are fully connecting all the dots as to the importance of Comrade George Jackson's connection to today's prison resistance movement. And trust me, sooner than later, they're going to be recognizing the connection and that this man's legacy still lives on, because he was a guerrilla, he was a resistance fighter, he was a freedom fighter, he was a revolutionary. He was the great example that we needed behind these walls in order to deal with the repression and suppression that we are dealing with today in this prison system as well as on the streets, because he's a fine example of a revolutionary for brothers and sisters that's on the streets as well.
Brother D, speaking from inside the U.S. prison gulag. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, went on prison radio to note the passing of one of Black America's premier social critics and a very funny guy.
Dick Gregory, the curtain falls. His name was Richard Claxton Gregory, born October 12, 1932, St. Louis, Missouri. But the world knew him and would remember him as Dick Gregory, comedian, human rights activist, social critic, and presidential candidate. As a young man, he won an athletic scholarship as a runner, which took him to college. But he really hit his mark as a comedian who told side-splitting jokes about American racism and segregation. He once joined Malcolm X at his speech at the Audubon Ballroom, 1964, a meeting of the Organization of African American Unity in New York. Gregory did what he always did. He told jokes. One of his most famous and remarkable jokes, after Malcolm introduced him as a revolutionary and freedom fighter, went like this. If the FBI ever tapped your phone, like they tapped mine, see, they didn't know. FBI wasn't used to tapping no colored folks' phone. Yeah, they came in with a $10,000 worth of equipment so they could tap my phone. And 2 days after they set all that equipment up, my phone got cut off. The ballroom exploded in hearty laughter. Most of the people understood that he was talking about something they knew about, FBI surveillance. But beneath the jokes and laughter lived a sober truth. For Gregory himself was a target of FBI surveillance in the COINTELPRO program. It's chilling to note that the FBI regarded him as a, quote, militant black nationalist, unquote, and his file was under the name Black Nationalist Hate Groups. Gregory, outspoken on many social issues, once criticized the mafia as the filthiest snakes that ever existed on this earth. What did the FBI do? Well, they sent his statement to the mafia. I kid you not. Think about that. Gregory was a good friend of both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. He sacrificed a multi-million dollar career in comedy to take the front lines of the civil rights and black freedom movements, where he suffered arrest, beatings by police, and, as we've seen, he became a target of FBI surveillance. He didn't just joke about the FBI. He survived the infamous COINTELPRO program. He lived through 84 winters of America. And in 1968, he ran for president and got 47,712 votes. Dick Gregory returns to his ancestors.
Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. A bill has passed the U.S. House and is now before the Senate that would make it a crime, punishable by 20 years in prison, to boycott Israel for its repression of Palestinian people's rights. Josh Rubner is policy director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. He says Israel's supporters on Capitol Hill are willing to gut the U.S. Constitution to protect Israel from criticism.
It's really quite amazing. Defenders of Israel often say, don't hold Israel to a different standard. Don't hold it to a higher moral value than any other countries. And here we have Israel's proponents basically trying to carve out an exemption in the First Amendment that would imprison people for up to 20 years for supporting an international governmental boycott of Israel or even just Israeli settlement products. It's really quite stunning and really incredibly dangerous for Democrats to be supporting the notion of imprisoning people with a line of political dissent that might go against the government in the scary era of Trump that we're in.
Yeah, this is quite amazing. The United Nations is a body that the United States is not only a member of and part of the Security Council of, but was instrumental in founding. And the UN binds the United States by law to many of its decisions. And now we have legislation that would imprison folks who promulgate the same views as are held by the United Nations.
You're right. It's really quite astounding that this bill has come about in this era, and especially when we've seen the United States vehemently oppose Israeli settlements on the official level for the past 50 years, obviously giving a wink and a nod to their expansion as we continue to fund Israel's military occupation. But nevertheless, I mean, it's just so ludicrous to think that someone could be imprisoned for 20 years for boycotting Israeli settlements when even the United States is opposed to them.
And now the reach of Israeli law seems to have come to the United States.
It's actually worse than some of the anti-boycott legislation that's been passed in Israel. So in Israel, if you advocate the boycott of an Israeli corporation, you can be sued for civil damages if the company can prove that they suffered losses as a result of your action. This is actually much more draconian, what is being proposed by Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, to actually jail people for 20 years for doing the same. It's really, really quite astounding that something like this could even be proposed in Congress, much less pick up the support of half of the Senate.
We've had some experience with this type of legislation in France. Tell us about it.
Well, in Europe, there aren't what we would call First Amendment protections. They don't have as definitive a line on protecting freedom of speech as we do in this country via the First Amendment. So there are all kinds of things that can get you in trouble if you say them in certain European countries. But in this country, we have much more robust protection for First Amendment speech, and the Supreme Court has acknowledged in the case NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware that organizing and advocating for boycotts are a protected form of political expression that occupy the highest rung on the hierarchy of First Amendment values. That's how strongly the Supreme Court has asserted that Americans have the right to boycott whomever they choose and whatever they choose. And here, again, you have Israel and its supporters trying to carve out this huge exemption in the First Amendment to not only fine people criminally for boycotting Israel, but also to jail them. It's just unbelievable.
Are you confident that this bill could not pass constitutional muster, that is, before the Supreme Court?
Well, I think because the American Civil Liberties Union came out so strongly against this bill earlier this summer and said that it's a direct violation of the First Amendment, I do think that it will have difficulty passing. And certainly members of Congress who have supported this bill have heard from very vociferous and very upset constituents at town hall meetings this summer how outraged they are by their support of this bill. But all that being said, I don't put it past Senator Cardin to try to sneak this language into another bill if he can't move it on its own, as he tried to do a few months ago. And I don't count out the fact that he will try to amend this in some way to try to get around some of the First Amendment concerns that have been raised. But the whole premise of the bill, in our view, is unconstitutional because it's premised on the notion that people who support a particular political viewpoint and who advocate for a particular line toward Israel should be penalized. And that, on its face, is a grave violation of the First Amendment.
Considering that the United States is the biggest sanctioner in the world, and sanctions are a kind of organized boycott, it's quite interesting that boycotting within the boundaries of the United States, at least regarding Israel, would be outlawed.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing to remember is that boycott is not a tactic of the left or the right. Everyone in the American political spectrum engages in these tactics to advance their political agenda. So again, singling out Israel for special treatment is exactly what the proponents of this bill are trying to do, to basically shield Israel from the growing movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions in support of Palestinian rights that's really sweeping college campuses. It's taken a huge hold within mainstream church denominations in the United States and is only expanding despite these very heavy-handed, very draconian governmental attempts to try to legislate against this movement.
So the intended chilling effect does not put this movement in deep freeze?
Well, I think that the Israel Anti-Boycott Act would, if passed, have a dramatically chilling effect. Its sponsors have claimed that no one is going to go to jail under this law, but really, do we want to leave that discretion to Jeff Sessions in the Department of Justice? I don't think so. But even if no one ever gets fined or no one ever faces jail time if this law is passed, you're right, it will still have a dramatic chilling impact on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights, because people will know and understand that there is still the possibility of them being imprisoned for advocating for this if Jeff Sessions should choose to prosecute.
And what's the next stage or step in this battle?
Well, we are still trying to make as much noise as possible during the August congressional recess to get additional members of Congress who have signed on to the bill to take their name off of the bill, as Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York did a few weeks ago. So we're keeping up the fight and trying to create the political conditions in this country that assure that Congress cannot pass this law when they come back in September.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.